Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. We're asking this court to reverse the judgment entered by the district court because the district court, in effect, bought the agency's explanation with all of its inconsistencies and with all of its disputes of material fact. And I want to talk mostly this morning about those disputes of material fact. The district court applied the honest witness rule to a witness who had lied under oath in his explanation of why the transfer took place and then admitted a short time later.
Too far, could you address the issue of whether there's an adverse action?
Yes, Your Honor. The district...
As you know, we're not bound by the district court's ruling on that.
Yes, Your Honor. And there's a case called Sulaki that came out, I think, December 29th of 2009.
I was wondering what you thought helped you in that.
The reason why I mention it is because it says that whether or not, you know, where there are these disputes of fact, that it's a jury question.
Well, what I want to know is the dispute of fact. I thought it was particularly interesting. The last paragraph of the charge there, which is the paragraph the court liked, it poses the question, does the employee experience materially adverse consequences affecting the terms, conditions, or privileges of employment?
Yes, Your Honor.
Objectively tangible harm.
The standard is in Burlington Northern and this court's decision in Rochon, and what the agency did is they took an attorney who was with the Office of the General Counsel who had a slot in OGC and put him in a
slot in OGC, and he was working actually in the office of the secretary, right?
On a short term.
Okay. And his actual work in approximately the 6 months, maybe more, before this assignment was on this manual relating to mortgage markets in developing countries, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And so what's the adverse change?
His understanding when he took the detail is that he would have a detail and then he would have a choice that they would mutually agree on the assignment when he came back. But in the absence...
Do you read that as giving him perpetual veto power over assignments within HUD?
No, Your Honor. He was entitled under the agency personnel regulations to return to his position in OGC, the detail to the International Bank. And then
he went back to OGC. He continued to work on, to the extent that he worked, on this issue of developing mortgage markets in developing countries. And then he was moved to an office which seems actually, by its name, more suited to that kind of work.
Well, Your Honor, as it turned out, it wasn't suited to that sort of work.
Well, how do we know that? How do we know that?
Well, you look at the testimony, for example, from Sorzano. Sorzano says, well, I have nothing for him to do here. There's no lawyer work in the Office of International Affairs.
Lawyer work. The position description, I'm not sure if that's the exact term for it, goes on for something like four paragraphs, short ones to be sure, about the kind of inquiries that they expect him to be doing there, which seem to be exactly the same as what he was doing when working on the manual.
Yeah, but that's not what he did. They had him doing research. They had him doing the low-level research.
Well, there was research. I'm not sure what you... do you have in the record some indication this was low-level research? What changed the level from what was going on before?
Well, he started off, he worked in that agency as a graduate school before he went to law school.
Yeah, let's focus on the work he was doing before he was reassigned. How is that work different from the sort of work that, so far as appears, he was destined for in OIA, a subset of the agency that he expressed interest in?
Well, he expressed interest in OIA 2 years earlier when OIA had $10 million in financing.
And the work that he had done in the meantime closely related to the sort of work that OIA seems to do.
Yeah, but it was not. What he was working on is a book that was designed, is a handbook, right, to assist in the development of capital markets to finance housing in third world countries. That, I would submit, is clearly legal work. There was no work of that nature in the position in an OIA.
Let's look at the position description at 1515 of the joint appendix. I mean, there are all these paragraphs, the last four paragraphs on page 1515. It seems to be all, that's what this is. And they say a very useful activity, it seems to me.
But that's not what he did, Your Honor. What they did is they manufactured the position description afterwards, and it had no connection to the reality of his assignments. But in addition,
Do we have testimony as to exactly what he was doing there?
Yeah, he was doing low-level research, not lawyers.
It's low-level research. I mean, yeah. If he thought the only type of activity worthy of the name was litigating or providing formal opinions as to legality, I suppose. But you might think that trying to develop criteria for promoting property rights and mortgage markets in developing countries would be extremely rewarding. And it was what he'd been doing.
But that wasn't what the position in OIA did.
Let me just ask you.
I'm sorry.
In OIA, in this reassignment, was there testimony as to the work he was doing after this reassignment to which he is objecting?
There's limited testimony. We relied very heavily on Ms. Sorzano's testimony that his skills and education and experience were not adequately being used when she was working for him. She didn't have work for him to do in OIA, and that's why she was essentially not advised of the transfer and why she did not want.
When he came back from the detail from the bank and he was allowed to finish this manual that he was preparing for the bank, he then asked to be assigned legal work. And that's when this whole question about where was he going to work in fact arose. Is that not correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, I mean, he'd finished at the end of October.
What's the timing of the request for legal work?
Well, he has a meeting at the end of October when he's finished the manual.
I thought his theory was that the assignment to OIA was cooked up in June.
It was. And in fact, there's the key email was dated October 15th, him to OIA.
So the cooking up, if that's the right word for it, occurs 4 months before the request for legal work?
It appears the process started back in June, Your Honor.
And there's no, all the time that he was in OGC not doing legal work until October, he doesn't say a word, right?
I think it's the OGC's and the agency's position that he was doing this under the supervision, doing the handbook under the supervision and direction of the Office of the Secretary. He finishes the handbook, the manual, the end of October. He has a meeting and he says, I want to go back to OGC. What he does not know is that a decision was made as memorialized in the October 15th email that he's going to be transferred. It's the email that begins per Matthew Hunter.
That does precede the request for legal work.
That's correct, Your Honor. We're going back to
I guess just if we take October 15 as the critical moment. Again, I go back to the question, how is the assignment inflicting objectively tangible harm and having materially adverse consequences vis-a-vis what he was doing at that time?
First of all, I'd respectfully suggest that the objectively tangible harm is not the standard, that it's the sort of standard that would dissuade a reasonable person from engaging in protected activity under...
Well, I don't know. We seem to have thought this was a good charge, at least that sentence of it.
Well, Your Honor, the...
I take it the object is to remove purely subjective claims of harm.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I would submit that a reasonable lawyer would refrain from asserting his Title VII rights if he knew that he could be transferred, in a sense, put into a dead-end job in a closet doing work that his employer said
was
far lower.
If this was so dead-end, why didn't he, during the long months working on the manual, keep knocking on the door of OGC and saying, give me legal work, please, right?
I don't think that he expected to realize that there were these discussions going on.
Whether there were discussions going on or not, why is it an infliction of harm, objectively tangible or not, to have him continue doing the same kind of thing?
Well, what he was doing with the handbook was legal work. What he was doing at OIA was not in the position description.
I mean, what basis is there for that? I just don't see it. The position description describes what is legal work of the kind of legal work that he was doing before. Maybe we shouldn't use the term legal work. X work. It was X work of the kind he was doing before. He continues doing it.
Because that's not what he did when he was at OIA.
And the only evidence of that is Sorzano's statement, we don't really need him.
We don't need him. We don't want him. There's no legal work. His experience and talents
are
not being...
There's a lot of sort of punning on the word legal work. And to
Could I just ask you, Mr. Carl, I thought the theory here was that your client had filed EEO complaints. And then the agency entered into a settlement agreement.
Yes, Your Honor.
It was partly written and it was partly oral. And the deal was that he would get details. And the first one was to the bank?
It was to the, I believe, the International Inter-American Development Bank. Yes, Your Honor.
That's what I mean by the bank. It was outside of HUD.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then he wanted to go to something, I think it's IIC. HUD said no. And according to the written agreement, the settlement agreement, after his detail, he would either go back to the Office of General Counsel or to a mutually, I don't have the language, but a mutually agreed upon position.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I thought that was the harm that was being alleged, that there was an agreement and the agency breached the agreement.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, Judge Williams is getting to, was there any prejudice in one sense? That's not what he's, but that's a way of looking at that questioning. All right, he didn't have a chance to participate in the decision as to where he was going to be transferred, as the settlement agreement said he would, but then says, and I'm reading into Judge Williams here, just so we don't have to repeat it, that he ended up doing legal work in the reassignment. So where's the harm?
He's denied the opportunity to give legal advice. There's no opportunity for promotion. The position description itself says all professional legal guidance regarding the formulation and development of the department's international programs and activities is received from the Office of General Counsel.
So can I just finish up? So you are not making this breach theory as the nature of the harm that your client suffered here?
I would submit it's the other side of the coin. He had this understanding, he had this deal, and the department, the agency, did not keep it. What they keep their part of the agreement, what they did is instead of sending him back to OGC where his slot continued to...
I realize you can have two theories, yeah. But I just want to be clear. If you have this theory...
Maybe I can help. I thought your theory was that the assignment to this office was itself retaliatory. Isn't that your argument?
The assignment to OIA...
Is retaliatory.
Was retaliatory.
That's your case, right?
I'm sorry?
That's your argument, right?
Yes, Your Honor, and that the...
And does the settlement have anything to do with that?
Well, he had a right to return to...
Well, but the settlement itself said it wasn't a legal settlement, right?
That's right. That was the understanding, and right. Our view is it was part written and part oral.
But the core of your case is correct, that the assignment to OIA was... That's the core of your argument, that was a retaliatory act, correct?
That's right, Your Honor. And the assignment to OIA is that he didn't get sent back to HUD where his...
Okay. And what Judge Williams is asking you is why was that an adverse action?
Right.
And our argument is that it was not a legal position, and if you rely only on what's in the position description, then you could justify taking a lawyer, putting him or her in a closet, and saying it's not an adverse action because your position description says that you are doing real legal work.
But you accept the proposition, or maybe you don't accept the proposition, that work trying to think about and trying to promote lawful mortgage markets in developing countries is legal work. True or not true?
That's certainly true, and that's what
okay.
He was doing
so,
with the handbook, Your Honor.
So unless we have some modifier here, it isn't a deprivation of legal. There are two ways on which it can be a deprivation. One is the position statement is a snare and a delusion, but we don't have any evidence, even though testimony was given in this case years after the reassignment. We have no evidence that he wasn't actually doing the stuff described in the position statement, right?
Yes, because what he says what they had me doing was research on my skills, my education is not being utilized, it's not a legal job.
We're trying to find that this is some way a deprivation from some benchmark. There are two possible benchmarks, I would think. One is what he was doing before was working on the manual, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Or a promised condition, right?
Well, he was promised the opportunity to return to OGC and HUD after his detail was over.
Well, he does go back to OGC, right?
No. Physically, he's there, but he's not. He's working on these projects under the aegis of the Office of the
Secretary. But he's certainly in a position to ask for legal work, right? OGC-type legal work.
He's doing the handbook, Your Honor, and that's why he's not at during the summer months of 2001. That's why he's not out looking for legal work. The end of October comes, he turns in the handbook, he has this meeting, and at that point he's looking forward to return.
Now, at that point, the detail is over, right?
Well, he's finished with the handbook. The detail outside the bank
is over. Before the handbook, the detail is over. He's back at HUD at the time of the handbook work.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? Okay. So this mutually agreeable position standard, effectively a veto power, a mutual veto power, in your view goes on continuously or what?
He has a legal entitlement to his slot in HUD, HUD's OGC. That's where his position is. When you go into detail, your slot stays there. He goes from his outside detail to working for continuing on this handbook under the aegis of the...
So bringing him back, apparently perfectly happily, to work on the manual in the office of the secretary, that doesn't satisfy the mutually agreeable position?
The understanding was that working in the office of the secretary was a short-term deal to give him. I mean, certainly he was looking at one point for a Schedule A political appointment, but that didn't materialize. He continued working on the handbook through the end of October. He turned in the handbook and was ready at that point to return to his position in OGC. And instead of allowing him to return to his position, they signed him to the Office of International Affairs, where there was nothing suitable for him to do. And part of this is in his testimony, and part of this is in Ms. Sorzano's testimony, where the transfer had taken place, and she wasn't even told. She certainly wasn't consulted.
Suppose it turns out to be the case that once he gets to OIA, he in fact does work which is indistinguishable, at least in terms of the level of challenge and so forth, from the work he's been doing on the manual. Has he suffered an adverse action?
Your Honor, we wouldn't be here. He went to
I take that to be no, he would not have suffered an adverse action.
I think, Your Honor, if he continued to have a real legal job.
A real legal job equivalent to the job working on the manual.
Or equivalent to the job that he previously held when
he was in OIA. Perhaps equivalent to that, but the or is the critical thing.
But the manual was over, Your Honor. And
I understand that.
We believe that the manual was a real legal job involving drawing upon his legal skills and abilities, and the assignment and working at OIA was not.
And you agree that the position description describes affirmatively as work that he will do, work that seems to be similar in nature.
They just made that up out of whole cloth.
Okay, but let's suppose they made it up out of whole cloth. But if, in fact, what he was authorized to do at OIA turned out to be work complying with the position description, you would agree no adverse action.
It might arguably be adverse insofar as there was no promotion potential, for example. But the fact of the matter is that he saw it as adverse. He saw it as a continuum.
How he saw it is not pertinent.
Taking him out of his legal, out of his slot in OGC and putting him in a dead-end job, irrespective of what the duties are.
You use a lot of labels, but you don't root them in any evidence.
Your Honor, taking an attorney out of the office of general counsel and involuntarily transferring him to a job outside of OGC where he can no longer say that he is practicing law, yes, I would submit that that is retaliatory under
Burlington. You couldn't say that in October. If by practicing law you mean litigating or giving formal opinions on the legality of particular actions.
Well, practicing law could include setting up structures for the financing of the housing market in the third
world. Okay. All right.
In your complaint, you, I think, also say, I'm curious about why you didn't mention this, when you're talking about why it's adverse in the complaint, at paragraph 36 to 40, you say there are other consequences here. He can't represent the agency at conferences, a whole bunch of these things, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that relevant to this question?
Well, it's part of that he's not in a real legal job in the Office of General Counsel. He can't give legal advice. If when he goes to seeks admission to the Virginia Bar, he cannot say, I've been practicing law for the last 5 years, and therefore I'm eligible to transfer in. He cannot go to, the agency certainly was not willing, for example, to finance his trip to ensure that he completed his continuing legal education requirements.
And is your point that he, while working on the report at OGC as a lawyer, he could have done all that? Is that your point?
If he'd stayed in the OGC. Yeah. Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. Just, you're saying that in terms of admission to the bar in Virginia, I'm not sure that that's a part of the federal standard, but assuming it is, that working on the manual, which he was doing perfectly happily while at OGC, would qualify as doing legal work within the Virginia requirement of doing legal work?
I believe it would, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And why is that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Why?
Well, because he's doing the sort of writing that a lawyer would do rather than the sort of research a graduate student would do, which is what he ended up doing at the OIA working for Ms. Sorzano.
And again, just I don't want to go over ground we've covered, but if I wanted to find in the record your best evidence from which a jury could conclude that, it's the Sorzano testimony?
I think, you know, just apart from part of Cronenman's testimony, the Sorzano testimony, she has a declaration in there, and I believe her entire deposition is in the record,
right.
And that talks about how she didn't have anything there that was really suitable for Mr. Pardo Cronenman. And our argument is that if the boss didn't think there was anything suitable in there, there wasn't anything for a lawyer to do, that should carry significant weight, and therefore it should be a question for the jury to resolve whether or not there was in fact an adverse action.
Okay.
But he never filed either an affidavit or testified in deposition as to what he was doing at OIA.
He testified at the EEO hearing. There's a brief summary in his declaration, but yeah, there's a lot of testimony that he was doing what he calls low-level research rather than legal work. And I would submit,
distinguish it from working on the manual?
I believe he did, yes, Your Honor.
I'll look for it. Didn't seem to be developed in your brief.
Well, that was an issue that the district court decided that...
I understand. And the government buried the argument in a footnote.
I'll just ask a quick minor question. My note said that while the first complaint was pending, he was promoted to a GS-14.
He had a series of EEO complaints back in the 90s, and as a result of one of those, I believe as part of the resolution of those complaints, he did receive the promotion to grade 14 in, I think, 96.
This is back in the 90s.
This is back in the 90s.
All right,
thank
you.
And he's been a 14
right.
Ever since that time.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, thank you,
Your Honor.
Give
me a minute. All right, thank you. Mrs. Lyons?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jane Lyons. I'm here on behalf of the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Sean Donovan. While I was originally prepared to start talking about three things in this case, the court has focused on the single issue of whether or not this reassignment was an adverse action. So I'll start there, if that would be all right. I have a couple of initial points to make, one of which is the record is not terribly well developed in terms of what assignments Mr. Pardo Cronenman was given once he arrived in the Office of International Litigation. Obviously, Mr. Pardo Cronenman protested the reassignment in the first place and exercised his...
In the Office of International Affairs.
Office of International Affairs, excuse me, Your Honor.
Well, I had a hard time with the briefs, candidly, following where he was and what office. But at any rate, he's in the Office of International...
He's in the Office of International Affairs, and he filed his EEO complaint and exhausted and went through that process before he undertook much in the way of any assignments. Mr. Carl has portrayed Ms. Sorzano's reaction as if it was a uniform and unchangeable reaction. Her initial reaction was one of surprise when she heard that a lawyer would be assigned to her staff, but she accepted the notion, and she said that it would be a fine place for him to work. In terms of the assignment,
I'm sorry, where did she say that?
She said that she would accept him on page 1211 of the.
Yeah. Where did she say it would be a fine place for
no,
him?
That's a meaningful place to work.
Meaningful.
It could be a meaningful place to work.
Uh-huh.
Your Honor, I apologize for my misspeaking of that word. That's on Joint Appendix 1211. And what we have from her about her first assignment in the Office of International Affairs, which is really all there is in the record about work that he performed there, can be found at Joint Appendix page 1289, where Ms. Sorzano testifies that his first assignment was to research and analyze the Puerto Rican housing laws and regulations as a guide to Latin America.
Where is that?
That is on Joint Appendix page 1289, Your Honor, on page 204. That's a one of those multi-page transcripts, and it's on page 204 of that page, lines 12 through 19. And it goes on a little bit more to describe it, that Ms. Sorzano had developed that assignment with her deputy, and that the general counsel's office played no role in it, which is utterly unremarkable. I think a lot of the energy has been focused on this notion of what do lawyers do, and lawyers do a whole lot of things, as Judge Williams has pointed out many times. Certainly asking a lawyer to research and analyze Puerto Rico housing laws as a guide to Latin America falls squarely within the bailiwick that Mr. Parter Kroneman had voluntarily placed himself over the last year and a half of
but
his
he says
work.
His position, his point, as I understand it, is that, well, first of all, none of this is in your brief, right? You don't make any of these points in your footnote about
the adverse footnote action. On the adverse action yeah. issue was relatively limited, Your Honor.
Right, yes. But isn't his point that, look, it's one thing to do this work in OGC where you're doing it as in an agency which provides legal advice and, you know, represents the agency in court and before agencies and with other offices. It's quite another thing to do it in an office where you're just sort of the researcher, where you don't have the legal responsibilities that go along with the OGC job. Isn't that his position? And that's why in the end the district court was right that there's a contested factual question here about how a reasonable person would react to this assignment.
I have kind of a two-part answer to that. Uh-huh. The district court was faced with the same record that this court has, right. And the problem perhaps is that there's no evidence in the record about what kinds of things came with the jobs in OGC that he had performed. Mr. Parter Kroneman mm-hmm. had been in several different divisions within the Office mm-hmm. of General Counsel. I'm sure within those jobs, within the Office of General Counsel, there were variety among the kinds of duties he was asked to perform. There's no evidence he ever was assigned to, say, litigate a case in a federal court on behalf of the agency. There's no evidence in the record that he ever issued a legal opinion or contributed substantively to a legal opinion. There's a dearth of evidence on what he was doing for the Office of General Counsel, what we know the most
court,
about.
The district court thought there was a factual question here.
Well, and it's perhaps, what I'm trying to suggest is it's perhaps a difficult assessment to make in light of the absence of evidence about what the general counsel duties had been. What we do have...
So what would we do about that? What do you urge that we do about that?
Well, I urge you to focus on the evidence, as Judge Williams was, with what Mr. Parter Kroneman was doing in the time leading up to the transfer, because that's the most relevant. I mean, it's...
On a motion, this is summary judgment.
This is summary judgment, yes, Your Honor.
Uh-huh. But
yeah, I'm just trying to find out where the dearth of evidence helps you.
I don't know that it... the evidence that I think is proper to focus on...
I mean, all that evidence was before the district judge, too.
Yeah.
The evidence that's in the record is what yeah. Mr. Parter Kroneman was doing in the 18 months before he was reassigned to the Office of International Affairs.
But what about his argument that what you're doing is you're comparing what you think he may have been doing in the Office of International Affairs to the last project he had in OGC for the secretary, right? And his position is that I want to be in OGC, I want to be a lawyer, and I want to do this work as a lawyer, and that you can't do in OIA because it isn't a legal division. Now, why isn't that? I mean, there is a rigid distinction in government agencies between what the Office of General Counsel can do compared to what non-legal agencies can do. And he says, I'm a lawyer. I want to function in OGC where I can use all my lawyering skills. I can't do that in OIA because it doesn't have the statutory authority to do that. Now, that's an accurate description of the difference between the two agencies. Why couldn't a jury conclude from that, yeah, if he thinks he's going to be a reasonable lawyer in OGC, is not about to file an EEO complaint if he thinks he's going to be transferred to a research office? Why isn't that? I mean, that's the issue we're asking here, right? We're not trying to decide it ourselves. The question is, what could a jury decide based on the evidence here?
The question is based on all the evidence whether there's a genuine issue of material fact yeah. about whether this reassignment is adverse.
Yeah.
Right. In.
And we have to take the evidence in the light most favorable to him.
Correct. But when you take uh-huh. the evidence here is of an agency giving Mr. Parter Kroneman what he asks for repeatedly.
Yeah, but it's in an agency that doesn't do legal work.
Of course, the agency does legal work.
No, not outside of OGC. It's not allowed to.
The OGC has particular functions,
yeah.
of course.
And he's a lawyer, and he wants to function in OGC. Because people in OGC can do things that people outside OGC can't.
That may be, but there's certainly no evidence in this record that lawyers only work in the Office of General Counsel.
No, of course they work elsewhere.
Of course.
But the lawyers who work elsewhere aren't functioning at the level that OGC lawyers are in terms of lawyering skills.
But neither was Mr. Parter Carterman by his own design, and the agency had been giving him what he wanted.
Yeah, but he said he wanted to stay after he was done with the report.
He said he wanted to stay
in OGC.
Well, he said several things, and in the letter
that... Is there any particular reason why you put this all in a footnote?
I honestly didn't think you'd be that interested in the argument.
Well,
I'm thrilled, but surprised.
Did you think we wouldn't be interested because it didn't have any merit?
No.
I mean, usually you put in your brief the arguments you think have merit, and, you know, you stick in the briefs, in the footnotes, the things you hope maybe... A judge, you might interest one of the judges on the panel, right? But, I mean, I don't put my major arguments in opinion. Well, I don't even use footnotes. But when I used to write briefs, I didn't put my major argument in a footnote.
I don't believe that this case can only be resolved on the adverse
okay,
action.
Okay, let's talk about
stronger,
some of the others, okay?
Perhaps a stronger argument.
Yes, let's talk about some of the others.
Let's do that.
Okay, yeah. So you said there were two other things you wanted to talk about.
Right.
So why don't we give you some time to do that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Instead of focusing on whether it's an adverse action at all, I think perhaps the easier way to resolve this case is to focus on the idea that giving an employee an assignment that he previously asked for can't be retaliatory. Uh-huh. Whatever it is, it can't be retaliatory.
Even if it's a completely different operation? I mean, he says when he asked for it, they had a lot of money.
Right.
Millions and millions of dollars. Now it's bankrupt.
Well,
and I mean, that's his argument.
Yes, but let's look at the evidence in the record. Your Honor.
No, that is the evidence in the record, that it was a well-funded million-dollar operation when he asked for it 2 years earlier. Now it's changed, he said. It doesn't have those resources anymore. I mean, that's in the record.
That is in his affidavit, Your Honor.
Viewing
yes.
the testimony
yes, in the light most
favorable
to him.
That's what's in the record.
Yes. But what's also in the record right. is the letter from July 21, 1999, which is Joint Appendix 1061 to 1062. And that's the letter in which Mr. Parter Carterman gets his detail to the Inter-American Development Bank. And on his return, he wishes to be considered for the Office of General Counsel or... the Office of International Affairs.
What's the date of that letter?
July 21st, 1999.
Yeah, how many years before the time of the assignment?
The time of the assignment? The reassignment is made. It started to be made around October of 2001.
Yeah, 2 years later, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But in
so
the intervening
that was
year...
Judge, I think that was Judge Rogers' point, that circumstances... have changed.
Okay, but wait.
Financial calamity strike, OIA?
I don't think it's a financial calamity in the classic sense. I think it's a government program that may have run its course, but here's my point. When he comes back to HUD, he asks to continue to work on the manual he's been working on while he's been at the Inter-American Development Bank. And the agency says, okay, do that. And he finishes that manual in October and presents it to the General Counsel. And at none of this time... In any of the times since he returned in April until October and beyond, does he ever ask for any work from the Office of General Counsel? He asks for a political...
He finishes the manual.
Yes, and he asks...
He asks for legal work.
And he asks... Well, he also asks for a political appointment. There is actually no record of him asking for any legal work prior to the people who made the decision, who began thinking about where to assign him, where to assign his skills within the organization. And given his expressed and repeated interest...
Wait, the record shows they knew, because this is all in the Office of the Secretary, that he was finishing up the manual.
They knew that's what he was working on.
That's right.
Correct.
And they gave him another assignment. They knew he hadn't finished it. So then they have this meeting and decide where they're going to assign him. He doesn't know anything about it. He finishes up the manual, and he asks the Office of General Counsel for legal work. Is that right? Isn't
that
what the record shows?
No.
What does the record show?
The record shows that he finishes up the manual, and he has in October. In November, according to Ms. Sorzano, at Mr. Hunter's urging, or Mr. Weidenfeller's, she attempts to interview him to sort of gauge his interest, perhaps, Exactly why she's interviewing him is not terribly clear on the record, but she's asked to interview him.
And she can't make the meeting.
She's
so
10 minutes late. She's 10 minutes late, and Mr. Parter Kroneman leaves before it happens. So that interview does not happen in November. But as of November, there's a clear sign that they're looking at him for
a position. But he doesn't know that.
He's asked to interview with the head of the Office of
Interviews. But he doesn't know why he's at that interview.
True. He could have asked.
No, but he doesn't. No, we don't know. Nothing in the record tells us why.
Okay, but nothing in the record tells us why. But there's
the question we're asking here is there sufficient evidence in the jury viewed favorably for the plaintiff, right? Is there sufficient evidence in the record viewed favorably to the plaintiff to go to a jury? That's the question. But that's the standard, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so
burden on the plaintiff.
So how can you, don't you think a jury might think, you're absolutely right. If an agency can't possibly be guilty of retaliation if it transfers someone to a job that person wants, but don't you think a jury might think it's a little suspicious that they decided to transfer him to this agency and didn't consult with him about it, didn't ask him whether he wanted to go?
No, Your Honor. People are reassigned within organizations all the time without being consulted about their preferences.
No, they don't have an obligation to, but the argument you're making here is that they did this for his benefit. They thought he would be interested in it. And don't you think, again, I'm asking you what a jury might think, not what you think or what I think, but what a jury might think. Don't you think it would be perfectly reasonable for a jury to say, well, that's odd. Why would they transfer him to an agency they thought he wanted to go to without consulting him, and in a situation where the head of the agency testifies that she testified two things. One, she said, I couldn't find out why they wanted to transfer him here. And two, we didn't have that kind of work for him. So that's, based on that, it seems to me, why couldn't a jury be quite suspicious about that?
There's no reasonable inference of retaliatory motive to be drawn from the following
evidence. Well, let me ask you about another thing then, okay? Because let's talk about Mr. Hunter's testimony here, okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so they're asking him whether plaintiff national origin was a consideration, right? He says no. You know what I'm talking about. You know what?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, fine. So at these meetings, they say, was it ever mentioned? He says no. Then he says, was the fact that he had prior EEO testimony a fact? He says no. Then he says, then the question is, did you know at the time of that meeting that he had prior EEO activity? Answer, no. Okay. So he's being questioned about whether his EEO activity might have played a role in this transfer, and he's saying no, no, no. And he even answers no to the question about whether he knew about it. Now, we know that's false, right? That he did know about it, that in fact the plaintiff gave him the EEO complaints at an earlier meeting. Okay, so again, the jury, from the perspective of a jury, could look at this and say, you know, we have some doubt about whether he's telling the truth about whether EEO activity played a role in the transfer, which then, if the jury has that doubt, then his next sentence reinforces the jury's view about it, because he says, I didn't know, and if I did know, I wouldn't have transferred a problem person like that to another agency. So what you've got here is, and the question I'm leading up to is, based on this testimony that I just described to you, the fact that the jury could conclude from that, that maybe EEO was a factor, and the fact that, number one, they didn't consult with him about a transfer they were making that he thought he wanted, and number two, the head of the office couldn't find out why he was being transferred, and the fact that Hunter himself expressed some doubts about the guy's work, right? Why isn't that enough for a jury to say, okay, I hear the government's argument about we transfer him here for this reason, But looking at all this evidence, we don't believe it, and we think it was because of EEO.
Your Honor, first of all, you have to look at all of the evidence.
I just did. I went through all of it.
Well, you left out some bits, which
what
I'd
did
like
I
to
leave
mention.
Out?
You left out the evidence that this is what Mr. Potter-Kornemann asked for, and you can put aside Mr. Hunter's feelings. They're really beside the point because Mr. Hunter at least believes, and this is unchallenged,
but
that he thinks he's giving.
See, you've got a classic case here of two possible motives. You've got the government's articulation of its motive, right? And you've got evidence to support his view of what he thinks the motive was. And that's why we have juries.
Respectfully, Your Honor, we also have summary judgment for this kind of case where the evidence taken altogether does not allow a reasonable conclusion of an improper
and
motive.
And viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff.
Even in the light viewed mm-hmm. most favorably to the plaintiff.
What evidence did you say Judge Tatel had left out? Yeah.
Judge Tatel left out, I mean, primarily it stems from the July 21, 1999 letter in which Mr. Potter-Kornemann expressly requests assignment to the Office of International
Affairs.
That's
your best case. That's your best evidence.
I never get to get here.
Okay.
Could I please?
The
next point is he never revokes that.
Never revokes.
He never tells anybody he doesn't want to go there anymore.
Right.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, keep going.
And
uh-huh.
when he is back at the agency after he's been on a uh-huh. detail to the Inter-American Development Bank doing international work, he comes back to the agency after they grant him some time off. And he comes back, and he presses people for more time to work on the international uh-huh. work that he's been doing, the same type of work uh-huh. on the handbook. And at the same time, he is also repeatedly asking for another detail, which he thinks he's entitled to. But in any case, the important focus is he's looking for more international work to do. That is what he wants to do. That is what he's saying he wants to do. And so assigning him to the Office of International
that's
Affairs.
That's what he would have done in IIC?
IIC. That's the Inter-American Investment Corporation, okay. I believe. That's what he's asking for, and that's what he, you know, ultimately gets to keep doing the same kind of work that he's been doing.
Mm-hmm. I don't have anything else.
Any further questions? All right. Judge Williams? No. You said you had 3 points, just so I know what they were.
The other ones I expected that we would talk about were the placement on absent without leave status.
Yeah.
That's an easy
mm-hmm.
issue. He admits he didn't obtain the leave, and so
okay.
that one's
your
pretty
answer
easy.
Answer to that is he was able.
Yes.
Right? Is that the simple answer to it?
He was not present for work without an excuse and right. no exigent circumstances.
All right.
So that the absent without
leave. You'll notice that counsel for plaintiff did not talk about that.
Yeah. Well, you got pretty active.
Right.
Yes.
And then the only other issue is whether the district court's very limited denial of the request for additional discovery after the 10-month discovery period had closed was an abuse of discretion. But I take it you have that issue as well.
I just want to ask you one question about that. Hold on a second. Let me find it. The district court extended discovery on December 8th, right, until February 9th?
That's my recollection.
Do you know, I can't tell from the record who asked for that extension. Was that counsel because she was ill?
I think that was the request that was done sort of telephonically on a status conference in terms of resolving a motion to quash or.
But she was not ill at that time?
In December?
Yeah.
According to her.
Were you counsel? Were you working on this case?
I was not, Your Honor.
Oh, you weren't, yeah.
I was not. Ms.
So Oslin's you don't know, you can't, you're just looking at the paper like we
I'm
are,
looking
right?
at the paper like you are. I can tell you that Ms. Osley does, in her declaration at JA-75, uh-huh. say she left work on November 30th in extreme pain. So it would be fair to infer
that's
that
what I assumed,
that
this was because of her illness.
I don't know that that was mentioned, but it's yeah. certainly an accommodation, I would say, for both
okay.
parties.
Okay, and beyond that, as far as you know, and I couldn't find this in the record, until the time when the government filed its motion for summary judgment, there was no additional request for an extension of time because of her illness, right?
No, the first, in fact, there is a consent motion for extra time for the right. plaintiff to respond to the government's motion for summary judgment filed in April. That's docket entered number 27 in the district court below. It doesn't mention Ms. Osley's illness. So the very first time mm-hmm. that they ask for more time, they don't ask for more discovery. It's not until they ask for additional time for another attorney to be retained so that they can respond.
Right.
And it's Mr. Carl who comes into the case and files the 56F.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. Counsel for appellant, you want a minute here?
Your Honor, with respect to Judge Tatel's question, there's an email in the appendix at page 086 from the assistant U.S. attorney consenting to an extension of the discovery period because of the health problems of prior counsel. Mm-hmm. And
but am I right that after that, between that extension and the, and I don't want to take your time up on this, but between that extension and the filing of the summary judgment motion, there was not another request for an extension of time.
No, there was not. Okay. Appears that Ms. Owsley was completely out of it because of
her. So what's your reaction to government counsel's argument about
all the evidence that Tatel supposedly did not address?
Yeah. Well, I don't, you know, the letter, for example, talks about a mutually agreeable reassignment, including a reassignment to the finance division in OGC, where Mr. Pardo Cronenman wanted to be in the first place. And that's what set off his initial filing of the complaint, that he wanted to go back there because financing housing was his dream, whether it's financing in third world markets or financing it in the United States.
Counsel, in your brief, you make the point that while working in the office of the secretary, and this is after the return from the detail, I continued to request the promised second year of his detail and submitted the proposed contract for a detail to IIC. Now, IIC wasn't doing OGC work, was it?
No, that was, he understood that he was entitled to a two-year detail, and he was asking them to keep the agreement.
Okay, so he was asking for a continuation of this non-OGC type of legal work.
No, Your Honor, he was asking for the fulfillment of the promise made to
him. Well, you can describe it any way you like, but functionally, he was requesting continuation of the same type of, if you want to call it non-legal work, fine. In any event, non-OGC work.
Certainly it's non-OGC work, and we disagree as to whether it was non-legal work. We believe that he was doing legal work.
It was definitely a request to continue non-OGC work.
That's correct. This was part of the settlement that he made in 1999.
He submitted this request, and you have a lot of sites, which I will check to see if we can get the dates of those requests.
I have, if I may have another 45, 50 seconds?
Yes.
Okay. With respect to whether, you know, there was really a legitimate reason for this reassignment, whether it was an A-team job, whether it was a good deal, whether he was doing Pardo Cronenman a favor, we'd submit that there's a dispute of fact, because if it was really a real job, a real legal job, if he was really doing Pardo Cronenman a favor, he would have asked Sorzano. He didn't even tell her that the decision had been made to reassign the Pardo Cronenman to Ms. Sorzano's office. Secondly, with respect to when this first meeting or first trip by Pardo Cronenman to Sorzano's office took place, there's a dispute of fact about that. Pardo Cronenman says the first, and this is the day he went down to see Sorzano and she wasn't there. He says in the his testimony that took place in June of 2001. And the citation of that is the appendix 1072. And, you know, the standard here is whether it's a material or substantial action that would deter a reasonable person from making or pursuing a discrimination claim, and we'd submit that taking any lawyer out of the office of general counsel and putting him someplace else is going to meet that standard. And finally, the position description was manufactured sometime later after his transfer, and that it really had, as we believe the evidence shows, it had nothing to do with what Pardo Cronenman actually did. And if you're going to bless an arrangement where an agency can create a position description and say, well, we're not retaliating against this person because, after all, he has a position description that makes it look like he or she has a real job, then you're opening the door.
And the record support for what you just said about that, in fact, he didn't have a real job is Sarzano's testimony, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what about the point that government counsel made that she ultimately said he could have a meaningful job there?
Well, but it wasn't legal work, and it was she never said, yeah, sure, it could be meaningful.
But it did include the assignment to work on the Puerto Rican laws as a model for Latin America, right?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor.
That's uncontradicted.
That's what you said, Your Honor, and we don't dispute that.
And where's the record evidence that about his testimony?
Well, he talks about it. It's in his testimony, his declaration, and his
testimony. That he was doing what?
That he was just doing low-level research, the same things he did before he became a lawyer, back when he was a graduate student working at HUD in the early 1980s.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
We will take the case under advisement.